University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents author Paul Grucco and his presentation, Thinking of Home. Grucco, who lives in Northfield, Minnesota, is the author of Journal of a Prairie Year, The Necessity of Empty Places, Minnesota, Images of Home, and Travels in Canoe Country. His essays have appeared in national and regional periodicals and have been reprinted in many anthologies, including The Best American Essays. In addition to his writing, Grucco owns a farm in southwestern Minnesota and has been an activist and frequent lecturer on environmental and rural policy concerns. He currently serves on the boards of the Minnesota Food Association and Friends of the Minnesota River Valley, on the organizing body of the Minnesota Institute of Sustainable Agriculture, as a member of the Northern Plains Land Grant Accountability Project, and as chair of the Commissioner's Advisory Committee on Scientific and Natural Areas of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Join us now for University Forum and Paul Grucco.
Thanks, Paul. Well, thank you for that lovely introduction, Mary. I confess that I do like introductions. When we get to heaven, if there is a heaven, and if any of us manage to get there, I'm convinced that a very large percentage of our time will be spent in getting ever more lavish introductions of each other. And the great blessing of heaven will be that we will believe what has been said. A friend of mine, the Minnesota writer John Hassler, says that a couple of years ago when he was up at his lake cabin in the North Woods writing, one day the plumbing in his house revolted. And he called the local plumber, who came and soon had the toilet disengaged and set aside and had out his snake and was busily working his way into the bowels of the plumbing system. And John was standing there in the doorway watching. And in the midst of this, the plumber, by this time his arms up to his elbows covered in an elementary substance, the plumber suddenly looked up at him and said, "Say, aren't you that fellow that writes novels?" And John said, "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I am." And the plumber suddenly looked grave and looked up at him, shook his head, and said, "Hell of a way to make a living." I often feel that way myself about this business, but when I come to a place like Lincoln, where the ghosts of so many writers still live in the landscape who have meant so much to me, writers like Mari Sandoz and Willa Cather and Lauren Isley and John Neihardt and Carl Shapiro and many others, it's really quite a wonderful role of writers who've come from this country. And when I come to a place like Nebraska Wesleyan and see people like Bill Clefcorn and Twyla Hansen and all the good writers who are working here in this community and who have also meant much to me in my own work as a writer, then I feel more sanguine about the whole business of literature. So I'm happy to be here. I've long had an eye for bones. As a child, I was absolutely compulsive about them. I guess bones were to me what weenie sticks are to Bill. I collected them and made museums of them. And there was one set of bones on the farm that I grew up on that held a particular fascination for me. The whole carcass of a cow that had been mired down in some mud and had died there. And I kept going back and back and back to those bones. I had first encountered them One November afternoon, when the leaves had fallen from the willows and the sedges had turned russet and golden, a pheasant bolted from the meadow grasses underfoot, startling me. And when I looked up, I was staring into the vacant sockets where the cow's eyes had been. The skull seemed to be staring back at me. My first impulse was to collect the bones of that mired cow, but I resisted it. Some integrity in them restrained me. Everything else in my collection had appeared at random, a skull here, a rib cage there, leavings scattered by scavengers, by wind, water, and frost. To pick up such a bone is to become part of its natural history, to join the forces of dispersal at restless work in the world. But the bones of that cow, for whatever reasons, had remained intact, held in the continuing entrapment of the sinkhole. The site harbored something more than a death. It seemed to me that the cow was entombed there, and my passion for bones did not extend to the robbery of graves. I was only a boy, but I knew something of graves. I knew the scent of gladiolas and strong perfume in the parlor where the embalmed body of my grandfather had been propped for viewing before the ritual of the grave. I felt the strong, icy wind blowing across the open prairie cemetery on the brown day when they were buried, and the cold clank of the pebble in the first shovel of earth hurled upon the burnished bronze casket. I remembered even then nothing of my living grandfather, but the memory of his bones lingers still. And I knew the smell of urine and rubber in the sick room of my grandmother, the same parlor that had held my dead grandfather. She had been laid out there in a rented hospital bed to die, insensible after a stroke. We watched as she shriveled up day by day into a sack of sharp-edged bones. I had dug my share of graves. I made one for the cottontail rabbit I had been raising in a chicken wire cage in the backyard. I had found it abandoned as an infant and had tended it all summer, feeding it with an eyedropper until it could be weaned. I brought it fresh tidbits from the garden, young cabbages and carrots and leaves of lettuce, treating it as the younger brother I did not have. "You've got to let that thing go," my father had been saying. "The sooner the better. It can't stay the winter in that pen. It won't survive." "Yes," I said, "I'll do it. Tomorrow." One admonishment led to another, one tomorrow into the next. There were many distractions, and I did not want to relinquish the rabbit. One morning late in September, I went out barefooted and still in my pajamas to greet it, and found it quivering in the corner of its box, bleeding thickly from several savage gashes inflicted by some predator that had improbably spared it. I wept over it and treated its wounds, but it did not survive the day. In the evening, I buried it in the grove, my heart heavier for the conviction vain, no doubt, that had it not been penned, it might have escaped. At that age, I still had faith in a benign and brotherly nature, and felt personally betrayed when it answered me in the language of violence and death. On another day, a hot one in July, I learned to speak the same language myself. I had a cat for whom I had vowed responsibility that had produced a litter of kittens. I could not keep them I had been emphatically told, and desperately as I tried, I could find no one else to adopt them. None of the farming folks I knew needed or wanted another cat. So one awful day, in a terrible heat, I took them into an abandoned hen house to do what needed to be done. One by one, I picked up the lovely mewing kittens and held them at the bottom of a bucket of water. When they stopped struggling, I carried them into the grove where the rabbit's bones rested, made 10 tiny graves for them, and buried them like pieces of my own flesh. I hated my own flesh then, hated the ruthless efficiency with which it could be made to do such dirty work, and would as soon have buried myself. But another part of me yearned to live as violently as those kittens had when they were suffocating in a water pail in the close heat of a July afternoon. There were many kinds of bones in those days. The leg bone our big tomcat had chewed off when it had been snapped in a trap and the leg itself had withered and rotted. The bones stinking like old tires burning of the family goats caught in a fire I had carelessly set. The neck bones of chickens crunching under the blows of my axe on butchering days. The carcasses of the rodents I had trapped, skinned, and offered to my dog Mitzi as a sacrifice of love. The bones of the ground squirrels I drowned in their holes and sold to the county government for a bounty of 10 cents a head. My life in those days had more to do with bones than it does now. I live a more genteel life these days, and one a lot farther from nature. The bones often told cruel stories, some of them of my own creation. What was I to make of this? The obvious thing, that life is sometimes cruel, I suppose. I couldn't explain cruelty, and I didn't try. When my father insisted that my sister wear skirts to the school bus stop half a mile away in vicious midwinter because he had religious scruples against females in trousers, and she froze her legs and whimpered all the way to school from the sting and itch of the thawing, I thought him cruel and stupid and pious to a horrible fault. But still I loved him, and so in her own way did she. It was a mystery, but when was life or love ever not a mystery? I vowed at a fairly early age to try to give up voluntary cruelties, stopped keeping wild pets, quit hunting and trapping for sport. I practiced a boyish and irregular asceticism, finding myself, although Protestant, powerfully attracted for a time to the most extravagant habits of the 3rd and 4th century desert Eremites. One saint whose name I've forgotten particularly enchanted me, I read that he had once spent 40 days and 40 nights sitting motionless in a swamp, enduring impassively whatever abuses came his way in penance for having swatted a mosquito, one of God's creatures. I did not dare to hope for such saintliness. But I did for a time passionately admire it. Still, I remained a cruel person. In the winter, I ate the sheep that had pulled me around the yard in a cart. In the summertime, feeling neither gratitude nor regret. I fished for northerns in the rapids below the dam on the river, not for food, but for the fun of it. For some grim reason, I particularly enjoyed beheading grasshoppers and spent many pleasant hours at it in the grain wagons at harvest time. It was a crooked world running along an ambiguous path overgrown with many obstructions. and I could not see the straight way through it. I suffer over this with my own children. Once, as we were sitting around a campfire, I absentmindedly crushed a cricket that had crawled near the flame. My daughter burst into tears. I didn't know what she was crying about, which made everything much worse. I begged her to explain what was wrong. "You murdered it," she finally said between her sobs. "Murdered it? Murdered what?" I said. She stopped crying, looked at me coldly. "I suppose you don't really know," she said coldly. I looked blank. "The cricket," she said, "the poor, helpless cricket. Why did you have to go and do that? It wasn't hurting anything, was it?" No, I had to admit it wasn't. At the same time, I was impatient and unrepenting. My God, I thought, I once aspired to an eremitic sensibility, and now I have raised one. "Be reasonable," I wanted to say. "And you know, there are greater tragedies in life than the wanton death of a cricket." But I kept silent out of confusion and embarrassment, and because I did not want to be in the position of endorsing wantonness, however trivial. I understood that in the moral sense, she was right. It is one of the troubles with morality, its indifference to distinctions of degree, its impracticality. My son, on the other hand, when he was younger, saw nature, as many children do, as something to pillage, to plunder, to maim, to shoot, or to catch. Every wild creature was meant, so far as he was concerned, to be carried home on a stringer, or carted home in a box or glass bottle. One night on a camping trip, we fished for bullheads, a sport in which I indulge him, although I do not enjoy it myself. That day we caught a mess of bullheads, and because the two of us were on an indulgent father and son outing, I agreed to let him carry them back to camp. Actually, after a few yards, I carried them myself, and promised to cook them for breakfast. We stashed the fish in the minnow bucket, watched the fire burn down, and the heavens come alive, and went to bed. An hour or two later, I was awakened by the clatter of dishes in the opened camping box, and peering into the moonlit night, I saw a raccoon sitting next to the box on the picnic table, picking marshmallows daintily out of a bag and eating them one at a time, very noisily and with much smacking of lips. A raccoon is an exceedingly handsome and beguiling creature. I rather regretted getting up out of habit and shooing it away. I stashed the marshmallows in the car and went back to bed. 15 minutes later, the animal was back. This time it took hold of the minnow bucket, dragged it a little way off, tipped it on its side, inserted one paw through the trap door to hold it open, and fished one bullhead at a time out of the bucket and ate it, smacking its lips even more loudly, having obviously a wonderful time. It was clear from the aplomb with which it executed this banquet that the raccoon was an old veteran of the minnow bucket circuit. Delighted, I made no attempt to stop it. The raccoon's gain was all the more mine. In my mind, I substituted pancakes for bullheads at breakfast and went contentedly, even joyfully, to sleep. And in the morning, I put on a sad face and confessed the tragedy to my son. I expected him to be heartbroken, but he wasn't in the least. He's always been an optimist, and he immediately saw the germ of a grand new opportunity. "I know what," he said, "let's go catch some more bullheads, and then we can use them for bait and catch that old raccoon." "But why would you want to do that?" I said. And then looking into his face and seeing the futility in such a question, I lied. "We'll see," I said. knowing that I was seeming to acquiesce in a scheme I had no intention of carrying forward. I want to find for myself some middle ground between the sometimes naive reverence of my daughter and the nature as sport attitude of my son. Once I think I had found it, but as my life grew more complicated, I lost it. I'm thinking of that brief time when I was a country boy and lived in the out-of-doors, essentially as one might occupy a living room. I didn't make distinctions then that I now routinely do, because the distinctions between inside and outside, between wild and domestic, between house and home, did not, for practical purposes, exist. In our little country church, I heard often the promise of heaven. I visualized it not as cloudy and ethereal, but as a concrete place, according to the words of Jesus, "In my Father's house are many mansions." I thought of my own Minnesota home as a smaller version of heaven, as a house of many mansions. There was the wooden frame house with the green mansard roof where I slept and ate and joined the life of the family. But it was only one of many mansions in which I lived contemporaneously. I lived, for one thing, in the hayloft where I stored my collection of bones. When it was too stormy to be outside, I was likely to spend the day there, swinging from the ropes, standing in the crow's nest at the peak of the gables, where I could see out across the river valley through a little round window. I kept company with the pigeons, red, napped in a bed of hay, teased spiders out of their chambers, daydreamed. And I lived in the enormous limbs of a black walnut tree at the far end of the pasture, keeping company with squirrels and pale little tree frogs. It was always shady there, and a fresh breeze always seemed, even in the stillest and hottest weather, to be blowing around it. Its limbs were broad enough to lie down upon, as I often did, listening to the lazy music of summer afternoons, the buzzing of flies, the droning of bumblebees, the singing of birds. I lived also along the shores of the pasture pond where the pussy willows swelled in the springtime and blackbirds wheezed and wheedled in the cattails and muskrats swam in the musty, warm waters of summer, green with algae and duckweed. I lived among the arrowroots and jewelweeds, among the strawberries hiding in the cordgrass, in the company of minks, weasels, and fat skunks. Water striders and boatmen and pill bugs squatted in my front yard, right-handed pond snails and leopard frogs in my backyard, dragonflies and damselflies in the fetid air overhead. I passed many happy hours in the upper reaches of a black willow tree, monitoring the progress of life in the fecund chambers of my pond mansion. And I lived by the blue light of the moon, along country lanes so quiet I could hear the traffic in the town miles away, visible only as a burst of mysterious light along the distant horizon. Fireflies flashed in the road ditches, and the long leaves of the corn sighed in the evening breezes. Here and there a dog barked in a farmyard. The sound of dogs barking in the night, of their barks echoing across the vast, empty countryside, was the surfacing sound of the wildness in them. I could hear in their voices the ancient cries of gray wolves in the days when great herds of bison roamed the plains and the moonlight danced in the endless waves of grass. I could feel then the wildness in my own bones. And I lived in a woodpile, in a plum thicket, in the striped shade of an August cornfield where the whirligigs raced across the sweltering landscape, showering dust like rain, and in a prairie meadow among overgrazed river bluffs on a granite island in the widening of the river along a grassy fence line where a lone green ash tree grew. And I lived along the banks of the river where beaver built their dams, mud turtles sunned on half-submerged logs, bullheads and northern pike, saugers and buffalo fish swam the waters, white-tailed deer came down to drink, the tracks of mink mingled in the shoreline mud with the remains of the deer-toe clams they had fished from the shallows. But mainly, I dwelled along the river, under the spell of its mysterious waters, running into the Minnesota River, then into the Mississippi River, then down the central nervous cord of the continent, over the plains of Iowa, through the hills of Missouri and Arkansas, across the bayous of Louisiana, and into the Gulf of Mexico. In my house, there were many mansions. When I sat on the overhanging limb of a willow tree, dangling my bare feet into the brown stream of the Chippewa River, feeling the slow, steady tug of its unfailing current against my toes, I had become connected to the great body of the continent. I was linked not merely with a small river in western Minnesota, but swept up into the gigantic stream of life. I lived then in the piney waters of the North Woods, in the thundering waters of St. Anthony Falls, in the icy rush of mountain streams, in the stagnant backwaters of southern marshes, in the oceanic brine. I shared then a mansion with my little bullheads, yes, but also with ancient paddlefishes and cutthroat trout and sharks and catfishes as big as logs. I lived then among bald eagles and alligators and panthers. I lived where it always snows and where it never snows, high in the mountains and at the edge of the sea. As a high school biology student, I once traced the cardiovascular system of a domestic cat whose blood vessels had been injected with a rubbery substance, red for the arteries, blue for the veins. Beginning at the heart, I traced the vessels up into its skull and down into its toes and out along its tail, following them as they branched into smaller and smaller streams. For me, it was an ecstatic experience. I carried my half-excavated specimen home in a clear plastic bag, unable to bear the suspense of waiting until the next day's class to discover where all the vessels ran. No one would sit in the same bus seat with me, but I was too excited to mind. There, in the body of the cat, lay a map of the world as I perceived it from my vantage point along the Chippewa River. I might be one tiny red corpuscle swimming in the slenderest of the tail arteries, but I was an undeniable part of something big and alive. A constituent particle of the whole organism. I had seen the universe in a $2 laboratory specimen. Now I live in a single house of 8 rooms, from which I venture forth into nature as a tourist. Most mornings I walk from my house around a shallow prairie lake to the 2-room office in which I spend my days pacing, reading, writing, staring out of the second-story windows into the canopy of a black walnut tree. It buds, it leaves, it flowers, it bears nuts. The yellow-green nuts turn brown and fall. The green leaves turn yellow and flutter to earth. In the winter, I watch frozen pieces of the tree break off in the wind and scatter to the earth. In the spring, the tree buds again. Some would call this a cycle, the eternal cycle of nature, and find comfort in it. But I don't. Every spring, the tree is a little older, and so am I. The progression, so far as the individual is concerned, whether it be a tree or me, is linear. It ends in death every time. The best that can be said in the meantime is that neither of us has moved. The skies beyond the tree change. One day dawns clear, the next cloudy. Some days rain patters against the window glass. Some mornings the branches of the walnut are white with rime frost, others with new snow. The wind blows or doesn't. In the heated and air-conditioned solitude of my study, it is all the same. One summer afternoon a year or two ago, the sky suddenly turned as black as ink. The streetlights switched on. A stillness fell, so deafening as to intrude even into my already silent rooms. Rain began to pour in a torrent, as it does in the rainforest on tropical afternoons. The downpour was swept and swirled by violent winds which howled in the corners of the building. As suddenly as the rain came, so came the hail, thundering down upon the rooftop and smashing against the windows. One by one, the panes of glass shattered while I cowered in the middle of the room, paralyzed with awe and fear. Then as suddenly as it arrived, the storm cloud passed. The branches of the walnut tree hung in tatters, and icy water puddled on the windowsills where the rain had been driven through the cracks in the glass. And in the streets, mist had already begun to rise from the drifts of ice, dissipating in the blazing heat of the sun. $10 million worth of damage in 10 minutes in one small prairie town. I thought of an outburst of John Berryman's in a classroom on another summer day. He came into the room, tottered down the aisle, as he did sort of weakly, carrying an enormous suitcase with a Cunard Line sticker on the side of it. He was working on the Dream Songs at the time all night and then coming to teach in the morning, and made his way up to a stage very like this. And on the way, he encountered a folding chair, which he suddenly, with some energy that came from where nobody could imagine, picked up and smashed into the orchestra pit. And then he turned to us and bellowed, "The function of janitors at the University of Minnesota is to keep professors from getting to their lecturers." And then he advanced to the lectern and said, "We were talking about Joyce." And he wrote a poem about it later, describing us, his bewildered students. He said, "It was a Zen touch, action in the midst of thought." But most days are not graced with such drama. They come quietly to a close, and I walk home, noticing perhaps whether it is hot or cold, windy or calm, passing through a landscape so familiar that I have ceased to see it, ready to take up residence for the night in the one house I now know, a gray one of 8 rooms, a tight fortress against the world beyond its windows. I take the telephone off the hook, throw the junk mail unopened into the wastebasket, and sit in the brown chair in the yellow light of a lamp, listening to piano music on a compact disc in the order that someone else has decided. There are rooms in that house that I seldom visit. And so far as I am concerned at that moment, there are no other houses anywhere else in the wide world. When I want these days to visit the mansions in which I once lived, I pack the car, arrange my schedule, consult maps, embark on an expedition to the local stores for perishable supplies, and set out from my house as a tourist. Fearful sometimes, but full of new energy too, as one always is at the beginning of a journey. And when I arrive and set out on foot into some untamed place, I come sooner or later to a bone or a shell. I keep my souvenirs here in my office with me, or on the mantle of the fireplace in my house, the tooth of a bison washed out of the mud of a Nebraska stream bed, the carapace of a horseshoe crab picked up in a Florida mangrove swamp, a bowl full of fossil shark teeth collected on a Gulf of Mexico beach, the shell of a land snail found in the sandy soil of an arroyo in the Baja Desert, the jawbone of a cow from the Great Basin of Wyoming, the antler of a white-tailed deer shed in the North Woods, the skull of a mule deer attacked by coyotes on Montana's Front Range. Every bone reminds me of many others that I left uncollected somewhere. Like the prophet, I have walked in a valley full of bones. The remarkable thing, in fact, is that one finds so few bones. Millions of creatures die every day. Where are their remains? Where have they all gone? And as for the dying creatures, where are they? You can walk for 1,000 miles and never once see a creature dying. Death is nothing if not discreet. The bones, everyone, are miracles. The alms nature offers to life. We now doubt the efficacy of miracles. They seem to fall beyond the boundaries of cause and effect. But a miracle is nothing more than a story that begins after the cause and ends before the effect. It is the mysterious void at the heart of the story, the space between the particles of a story, like the space between the particles of an atom, that makes the substance of things possible. The miracle of a bone is that it is a moment frozen in time, the evidence of something particular that once lived, something unique, unprecedented, and never to be repeated, which has vanished and nevertheless endures in the bone. A faint white glimmering in some offhand place of life everlasting. Thank you very much.
Today's guest on University Forum has been author Paul Grucco. His presentation was entitled Thinking of Home. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.